So, good morning, everyone. Glad you all felt like you could come and take refuge in a cool space on a hot summer morning. Except it'll get hotter yet as the day goes on. So, not to put you on the spot or embarrass you or anything, but when you were meditating just now, did anyone here notice your mind wandering into the past?
Future.
Or the future. Yeah, future some. Yeah, or into a kind of dream fantasy land. That too. Yeah, well, so you're not alone. This is a pretty normal way for the mind to behave. Now, did anybody here feel a little frustrated about that mental tendency? Maybe just a little. You know, sometimes we think, oh, I'm just not a very good meditator, or after all these years of sitting, my mind still ... Be here now. Live in the moment. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. We've all heard these what really have become cliches in our time, almost. And yet, everything in our cultural environment, in our social environment, conspires to obstruct our receiving the gift of the present moment. And the mind is strongly habituated not to be still. We say, well, I'm going to sit here and follow my breath. That we set our intention to do that. And then the mind says, excuse me, I have work to do. I have to replay that meeting yesterday and see what you should have said. Or, I have to worry about that job interview next week. And by the way, remember how your mother said you never amount to anything? No wonder you're such a mess. You know, this is our mind, right? How can you pay attention to your breath with all that going on? But the wonderful thing about this practice is that you can. You really can. Stillness is our birthright. It's our natural. It's a natural state to us. Quietness, as well as activity, they're both natural. But we forget. With practice, we can establish a foundation of mindfulness of breath and body, from which we expand our awareness to include, well, pretty much everything that manifests in our experience from moment to moment, including past, including future, as they manifest in the present, which is the only way they can. Right, when we are experiencing a memory, we're experiencing it in the present. So there really is no such thing as anything but the present moment, and maybe not even the present moment. We'll come to that. When we look deeply into the nature of time, this is what we discover. So I'll come back to this question of time, but I want to talk a little bit more about the mind and the misconception that the goal of our practice is to have a completely empty, blank mind. It's hard not to want an experience of deep stillness and dropping away of the boundaries between self and world. And it's good to have such experiences. But we get in trouble if we think that that's what enlightenment is, and that it's something we can get and hold on to. Ultimately, our practice is simply to be fully awake and aware and present to each moment of our lives, just as it is, without clinging to what we want, without pushing away what we don't want. And so we need a certain amount of mental strength and stability to do that. So we use meditation techniques. We use following the sensations of our breath, or counting the breath, or scanning the body to help the mind to settle. But our practice is not simply to banish all thought from the mind. If you've tried, you know how hard that is. You know, if you try to force the mind to be quiet, how hard the mind pushes back against our attempts to control it. I love the expression coined by the Japanese teacher Uchiyama Roshi, opening the hand of thought. When the mind wants to grab onto a thought, either to hang on to it or to push it away, we simply take a breath and relax our grip. Let the thought go, open to the next moment. Uchiyama Roshi rather amusingly, but helpfully, advises us to think of our thoughts as secretions of the brain. Just as it's the job of our adrenal gland to secrete hormones that signal our body to respond to stress, it's the job of our brain to secrete thoughts, right? To help us. It's not a gland, but anyway, it's the brain's job to think, to help us process the huge amounts of information that come to us through our senses, and to integrate that information so that we can respond to our environment, right? So we don't need to be upset or frustrated when the mind is active during zazen. It's just trying to do its job. We need memory and foresight to be able to think well and function effectively in the everyday world. This is poignantly evident when we look at the lives of those whose memory is severely impaired through injury or illness. The writer and neurologist Oliver Sacks tells the story of a young man who was living in an ashram with the Hare Krishna people. Remember the Hare Krishnas who would be chanting on the street corners back in the 60s? So he lived in an ashram. He, after having given up drug culture and was attracted to the spiritual life, moved into the ashram, and about a year later experienced vision problems. His eyesight was dimming, and his guru said, "That's a sign of your spiritual progress." So it continued, and over time, not only did he become blind, but he became very, very flat emotionally, and experienced physical changes as well. And finally, his parents, with whom he had cut off all contact, but they had received periodic messages from the guru saying, "Your son is..." They really thought that he was becoming an enlightened master, that he was so serene and untroubled, that he was achieving a high spiritual status. But his parents intervened, and it turned out he had a huge tumor that had destroyed his pituitary gland as well as his eyesight. And after surgery, he was profoundly impaired in short-term memory and amnesic for most events past 1970. So he could remember the Grateful Dead really, really well. But And that was really this point of connection for him and Oliver Sacks, who met him when he was 25 in a long-term care facility, to see, you know, where was there a spark of life in this young man still. I just wanted to read you. A bit of Sacks's description. He said, left alone, Greg, which is the name he gives this young man, would spend hours in the ward without spontaneous activity. This inert state was at first described by the nurses as brooding. It had been seen in the temple as meditating. My own feeling was that it was a profoundly pathological mental idling, almost devoid of mental content or affect. It was difficult to give a name to this state, so different from alert, attentive wakefulness, but also clearly quite different from sleep. It had a blankness resembling no normal state. So I tell this story just to make a point by exaggeration that this is not obviously what we're aspiring to. And it's tragic. The writer Abigail Thomas, in her memoir called A Three-Dog Life, great title, offers another perspective in her description of her life after her husband's traumatic brain injury from a car accident, which resulted in virtually total loss of short-term memory. Do you remember, you know, the expression Three Dog Night? It was some rock group, right? But I learned years later that it's an Australian Aboriginal expression for a really cold night. Because on a three-dog night, you need three dogs to keep you warm. That's where that originally came from, apparently. And so her life became a three-dog life after her husband's injury. There she is with her three dogs. After his injury, his disorientation and fear were so great that she really was unable to care for him at home and had to put him in a long-term care facility, although he would come home on day passes for visits. I thought I'd read you just a little bit of her description. Sometimes when I arrive, Rich is still asleep, his face relaxed, looking so like himself that I can't believe he won't wake up and be all better. Other times he is up, stalled in the middle of whatever he began to do, his back to the door, his arms raised like a conductor, motionless, as if he were playing some cosmic game of statue. Or maybe he sits on the bed, a pair of socks in one hand, his trousers laid out beside him. After our usual greeting, Abzi, that's his nickname for Abigail. Abzi, how did you find me? Or, what time did you get up? I didn't hear you. He lapses back into silence. The nurses say he can stand in front of the bathroom mirror for an hour or more, toothbrush in his hand. In brain injury jargon, perhaps this is what is meant by difficulty completing a task. The first time I heard this term, I imagined a child who can't manage tying shoelaces, a grown-up who forgets how to scramble eggs, some kind of visible difficulty, frustration, something that could be relearned. I didn't know about the getting stuck. For my husband, there is no such thing as a minute ago. There is no, but we've been sitting here for an hour and a half. That information has nowhere to lodge in his consciousness. He has a collapsing past. If he doesn't remember, he doesn't believe. And if everything is now, what's the rush? I used to try and coax him, nudge him on, but that only made him angry and confused. So I have adapted. I join him. We sit and steep ourselves in 1037, a single moment, while outside this room an hour disappears, bypassing us. I'm always surprised when I look at the clock and find how long we've been there. So she learned about time in a pretty hard way. How to live in the moment. And she also learned, though, how to love her husband and be with him in his altered state, and how to rebuild a life for herself in the world without him. She couldn't live in his world, and he couldn't live in her world all the time. So clearly, we need our thoughts. We need to be able to think well and use our human capacity for memory and foresight to function in our lives and in our relationships. The trouble with thinking, though, is that we tend to think way more than we really need to for optimum effectiveness, right? We waste a lot of time and energy fretting, replaying the past, worrying about the future, perseverating. We spin our wheels deeper and deeper into the neurological ruts made by the inevitable wounds we receive in life, by our me against the world response to threat, so that we armor ourselves against experiencing the truth of this moment, the extent to which we are actually connected to the world right now. Now, of course, there are times we do have to respond to threat and keep ourselves safe, but mostly we spend way more time in defense mode than our actual life and relationships warrant. So our relationship to the past and the future becomes an effort to understand and control our lives so that nothing bad happens to us or those we love or what we care about. To think about the past and the future, we have to imagine past and future. We need to form images in our mind, right? Now you might say, well, yes, when I'm imagining the future, I'm using my imagination, but when I remember the past, I'm remembering what really happened, right? But when we use our memory, we construct images in our mind. Just like when we imagine future, we construct images to imagine the past. Or verbal replays of conversation, since we're such verbal creatures. But these are reconstructions. They're not the experience itself. We're experiencing now a reconstruction of what we call the past. But the past, it actually doesn't exist in that moment. And yet, the past is present in the moment as well. It's one of the great, another great Zen paradox. And the more we really observe the mind in how it constructs the past and the present, we realize that both memory and foresight are always partial. They're only part of the picture, right? It's only our little part. Always partial, always provisional, temporary, based on our limited perceptions and views, and subject to revision and change. Every single memory we have, every single projection into the future we have, that is true. Maybe you've observed how different family members have such different memories of the same event, right? People get telling stories, oh no, that's not what happened, right? I know what happened. I know what you said, right? Or maybe you've had the embarrassing experience of being convinced you remembered something, that you were there for something that it turns out you were not there for, that you just heard everybody else talking about, or else you saw the pictures, but you weren't actually there, or else you've caught someone else in that delusion. Happens all the time. Or maybe you've noticed how easily the brain fills in gaps in the memory, makes something up. Or confuses two similar facts. Happens all the time. Or it's easier to catch somebody else at it than it is ourselves. So the more we look into the nature of memory and imagination, the more we see the nature of the mind and the nature of time itself. And I think this is the key to how we can practice with past, present, and future as they play out in our meditation practice and in our lives. Dogen Zenji really wrote and thought about the nature of time quite a bit. So I'm going to read you a little excerpt. Dogen Zenji, of course, the founder of our school of Zen in Japan, 13th century. And this is one volume of the Shobogenzo, his masterwork. So he said, know that through causes and conditions, a human body in this lifetime is a temporary assemblage of the four great elements. So I don't know why he says only four: earth, water, fire, and air. And often it's mind is another one. And the five skandhas, which are also the components of consciousness. It also contains eight sufferings, eight kinds of suffering, the human body. Further, it is born and perishes moment by moment without ceasing. It is born and perishes at each of the 65 moments contained within one finger snap. One finger snap, 65 moments. And because of ignorance, we don't notice it. There are 6,400,099,980 moments in a day and night. And the five skandhas are born and perish at each moment, but we don't notice it. What a pity that although we are born and perish at each moment, we don't notice it. So the Sanskrit word for moment that he's referring to here is kshana. And it's when he says there are 65 moments in a finger snap. A Buddhist dictionary will tell us that a kshana is a 75th of a second. 1/75th of a second. So it's quite remarkable that this very, very ancient tradition actually syncs up pretty well with what contemporary neuroscience is telling us. The neuroscientist Francisco Varela once studied the time it takes subjects to recognize an image. So he discovered, and he did this with, you know, electroencephalograms and all that, electrodes, etc. He discovered that there is a gap of up to 180 milliseconds, so a millisecond being a thousandth of a second, 180 milliseconds before there's any brain activity. So there's the image, and then there's this little infinitesimal gap, and then up to 360 milliseconds before the neurons fire up in an attempt at recognition. So they know there's the brain knows there's an image there. The brain's sort of casting about, what is this? And then there's a recognition that there's something. Then the next step is figure out what it is. And then there's something that's called synchrony scatter, where neurons all over the brain start firing in an attempt to figure out what this thing is, checking out memory, checking out information that's broadly scattered throughout our brain. So that takes up to another 540 milliseconds. And then at about 720 milliseconds, there begins to be some kind of response, like a motor signal to the initial stimulus. So when we consider that 10 milliseconds is 1/100th of a second, these moments of perception are very close to the moments of Dogen's finger snap, the 1/72nd. How remarkable, huh? So a finger snap, what seems instantaneous is actually not. So even our perception of the present is actually already too late. It's gone. There's this tiny, tiny little gap. So when the Dalai Lama heard about this research, he was really excited. He loves hearing about this sort of thing at the conferences, the mind and life conferences that he holds. And he was good friends with this researcher. There's another remarkable correspondence between Dogen's description of the way each moment is born and dies with contemporary particle physics. And Wayne, forgive me, this is going to be kind of a crude reference to that. But I was particularly intrigued when I heard about the concepts of what are called implicate order and explicate order, which were coined by the physicist David Bohm to describe what are kind of two frameworks for understanding phenomena, reality. The implicate order, he also called enfolded reality. It's the fundamental ground of existence. And the explicate order, or unfolded reality, is the phenomenal world that we perceive. And he describes this coming into and passing out of existence, right? This unfolding and enfolding. As a kind of superfine oscillation, so that the realities are essentially simultaneous. So he claimed that with matter, as with consciousness, each moment has a certain explicate order, the order of unfolding and becoming. And in addition, it enfolds all the other moments, though in its own way. And this resonates with the holographic principle, by which every point in a holographic image, have you seen holographic images? Every point contains the whole three-dimensional image. And resonates also with the each point in space and time containing all of space and time. Dogen amazingly describes this quality of reality in a fascicle of the Shobo Genzo called Uji, which is translated as the time being, which for those of you who've read Ruth Ozeki's novel, A Tale for the Time Being, she weaves this in quite skillfully. Or the actual order of the characters, U, is being and G is time. So it's being time. Being time, and what Dogen tells us is that we are time. We are time. Time isn't this external thing. Dogen says, know that there are myriads of forms and hundreds of grasses. So grasses here are phenomena, the myriad phenomena, throughout the entire earth, and yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. The study of this is the beginning of practice. When you are at this place, there is just one grass. There's just one form. There is understanding of form and no understanding of form. There is understanding of grass and no understanding of grass. Since there is nothing but just this moment, the time being is all the time there is. Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. Do you think that time merely flies away? Do you see flying away as the only function of time? Sometimes it feels that way, doesn't it? If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is that you think of time only as passing. In essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being. So we could spend a number of sessions going through this particular text, and it's a lot of fun to do, but that's not what I want to do today. I don't want to be so heady and theoretical. I really want to consider how we can apply this teaching to our Zazen practice, and by extension to our lives. How can we look deeply into the boundlessness of space and time? Well, by slowing down, by sitting still, breathing in and out, paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience. When we do that, soon enough we see that sensations, perceptions, feelings, thoughts, memories, images, replayed or imagined conversations, all that arises and passes, arises and passes. Phenomena of the mind, being born and dying in each moment. Insubstantial as a dream, arising through the medium of this living body and mind, and yet not bounded by it. The world is constantly flowing through us, and we are constantly interacting with the world through all our body-mind systems. And our preciously held ideas, memories, plans, though we need them to function, they're always provisional, always contingent on everything else, always partial, always subject to change. You've probably noticed how your view of your own past has changed as you've matured. You don't have the same view of your past as you had when you were 20, I hope. how you have different insights into your parents and their lives when you reach the age they were when you were a child or a teen. Your past changes as you change, hopefully. When we deeply understand this, we are freed from our rigid habit patterns of thinking and reacting to the world. And I don't mean understanding in an intellectual way. though that helps too. But I really mean understanding based on how it feels to let go. To let one moment die and the next be born. To let go of our stuckness, our holding on. When we do that, we alter our relationship to past and future. We open up our perspective to our true interconnectedness with beings throughout space and time, and we let go of our narrow self-focus, and we open up to compassion, actually, towards ourselves and towards others. And when we make that shift, even for a little while, even just small openings, the past changes, reconfigures. It's not what we thought it was, or what everyone was telling us it was. We can't change it, but we're free of it. And oddly, we're free of the future, too. Abigail Thomas, who I quoted earlier, talks about how her relationship to the future changed after living for years with her husband, present tense experience. She says the future used to be the place where the bad stuff waited in ambush, right? My children were embarking on their futures in fragile vessels, and I trembled. I wanted to remove obstacles, smooth their way. I wanted to change their childhoods. I needed to be right all the time. I wanted them to listen to me, learn from my mistakes, to save them a lot of grief. Well, now I know I can control my tongue, my temper, and my appetites. We're doing pretty good if we can do that, don't you think? My tongue, my temper, and my appetites, but that's it. I have no effect on weather, traffic, or luck. I can't make good things happen. I can't keep anybody safe. I can't influence the future, and I can't fix up the past. What a relief. Now, I don't really think that she means she cannot affect the future at all. I don't think what she's describing is a kind of, well, whatever, a resignation. Of course, we do what we can to speak and act in beneficial ways in the world rather than harmful ways, and that does make a difference. But we're not in charge of the show. We can't micromanage our lives and everyone else's. She's comparing her view with her earlier self-focused preoccupations and worries and seeing that she's been humbled by life. And it's a relief. Life does teach us if we pay attention. I don't think the Dharma is actually highly esoteric knowledge. It's the way life is. The great matter of life and death teaches us. Our practice just makes us a little more open to receiving the teaching life has to offer us. As Dogen said, with this law of birth and death, in each moment, sentient beings create wholesome and unwholesome actions. Also, with this law of birth and death, in each moment, sentient beings arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and attain the way. So, our experience of past, present, and future is the great matter of life and death. The whole thing is the gift when we fully receive it.